The Guardian.
Hello, it's John Dennis with Guardian Weekly on May the 14th. International news and opinion from our team of reporters and commentators. This week, an earthquake in China kills at least 10,000 people. China accepts help from the international community and reports the disaster on its state media. But by contrast, in Burma, where more than 100,000 people have died after Cyclone Nargis, the military junta is stopping aid workers from entering the country. In Zimbabwe, pressure on the opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. His supporters are attacked by Mugabe's thugs while he's been out of the country.
I think there's a growing feeling that he should have been back in Zimbabwe at their side, drawing attention to their plight.
And as the US resumes state executions after a seven-month hiatus, the human rights lawyer Clive Stafford Smith gives his reaction.
These things come and go, and we've lost a lot over the years, but I think overall we're still winning the battle.
China's worst natural disaster in 30 years has killed at least 10,000 people. China's state media says the death toll is likely to soar after the earthquake, which measured 7.9 on the Richter scale. Its tremors were felt as far away as Vietnam and Thailand. Schools and hospitals, factories and offices, and thousands of homes have been flattened and roads destroyed. The worst affected province was Sichuan, about 1,600 kilometres southwest of Beijing, where 7,000 died in one county alone. The Guardian's Tanya Branigan is in Dujiangyan.
We are in Chengdu at the moment, which is about 60 miles away, roughly, from the epicentre of the earthquake. And this morning we actually managed to get through to Dujiangyan, which is a place that's been really quite badly hit. It's not been levelled in the way that we understand other areas may have been, but certainly there's been a huge amount of damage. Everybody was camping out overnight. Nobody dared to go back into their homes. Although quite a lot of buildings are still standing, many of them are very badly damaged. You can see the cracks, and a lot of them have simply collapsed. And of course, people were terribly worried about aftershocks, and in fact, some of them thought they felt them during the night. They've spent the night on the streets, huddling under anything they can because it's also been pouring with rain, and that's obviously made the rescue efforts more difficult as well. And as you go through the streets, you just see these enormous piles of rubbish where buildings have just collapsed where they stood. And perhaps the worst incident there is the collapse of the school, which had about 450 children. Now, originally it was thought they were teenagers. It's actually a primary school, so they're even younger. They're between around 7 and 12, we think. And it was a really awful sight. Hundreds of parents outside, desperate, anxious to try and get any glimpse of what was going on, being held back, really pressing, at some points fighting with the troops to try and get in and get a glimpse of the school building. Initially, it was parents leading the rescue attempts, and then troops arrived at around 10 o'clock last night. Unfortunately, the feeling is in many ways that may have been just that bit too late. They pulled out several children alive yesterday. They did pull out some more this morning who've gone for medical treatment. And of course, one of the problems is that even one of the hospitals in the town has collapsed, and so they're having to be taken into Chengdu and perhaps even further afield. But mainly, unfortunately, what we were hearing from eyewitnesses there were that most of the people who were being recovered this morning were pulled from the rubble.
Tanya Branigan. Well, the Chinese government has welcomed offers of aid from outside the country, in sharp contrast to the attitude of the Burmese regime. 100,000 dead, 1.5 million homeless. But almost 2 weeks after Cyclone Nargis, and aid agencies say that just 10% of the relief workers needed to help survivors have been allowed into Burma. The military government accepts aid from the outside world, but foreign logistics teams are still waiting for visas. The UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says it's unacceptable.
I want to register my deep concern and immense frustration at the unacceptably slow response to this grave humanitarian crisis. We are at the critical point. Unless more aid gets into the country very quickly, we face an outbreak of infectious diseases that could dwarf today's crisis. I therefore call in the most strenuous terms on the government of Myanmar to put its people's lives first.
Well, that's Ban Ki-moon. Ian Wolverton from Oxfam is in Bangkok.
There are a number of promising signs now that the Myanmar authorities are beginning to be more relaxed with visa restrictions. And aid is getting into the country. I think it's important for listeners to know that operational NGOs, relief agencies are able now to provide humanitarian assistance to many of the people affected by this terrible disaster. But what's clear is that there still needs to be a fairly significant scaling up of humanitarian relief into the country so that the millions of people affected by Cyclone Nargis can access humanitarian aid quickly.
But if the aid is getting in without the logistical workers needed to transport the aid to the people that need it, how effective is that?
Again, I think it's important to realise that although some aid agencies are struggling at this time to get access to Myanmar, there are a number of humanitarian relief agencies that were operating before the cyclone struck parts of Myanmar and are able to access people affected by the disaster. So a number of our sister agencies at this time are operating in Myanmar, and we're providing them with technical assistance and in some cases funding as well. So that's agencies like UNICEF and Save the Children. So although it may seem as if the international community and the relief agencies of the world are in this case effectively unable to provide assistance to people affected, it's not actually the case. There are a number of agencies within Myanmar providing assistance to people affected by the disaster.
Some countries, including France, have advocated acting to help the Burmese people against the will of the country's military regime. Is that a realistic proposition, do you think?
Well, Cyclone Nargis is a humanitarian crisis which requires an immediate, large-scale humanitarian response. The situation in cyclone-struck regions is dire. It's critical that international agencies such as Oxfam and others are permitted to work in countries so we can assist the millions of people affected by the disaster. And although all diplomatic efforts are helpful, at this time I think we need to focus solely on the humanitarian assistance package. It's not really useful to be getting into a debate about the politics of providing aid. What's clear now is that we need to be able to access as many vulnerable people as possible.
Ian Wolverton, many thanks for talking to us. Well, here's what The Guardian's columnist Simon Tisdall says.
The question is, what can you do about it? It ranges from Bernard Kouchner, the French foreign minister, saying last week that perhaps aid should be supplied direct without reference to the regime, through to countries like Russia and China, which traditionally oppose intervention in other countries' affairs on the principle that sovereignty should not be infringed. I mean, the debate which is developing as we speak is whether Britain, which is currently president of the UN Security Council, should convene the council and move towards some sort of emergency measures which might include direct airdrops of aid into Burma, whether or not the junta agrees. It seems to me that there's no problem about international intervention. It can be done, but it seems always to happen in the wrong places at the wrong times. Thus, we have a massive intervention in Iraq in 2003, another in Afghanistan in 2001, prospectively one in Iran. But these are not for the right reasons. These are not for humanitarian reasons. These are for security and commercial reasons.
Simon Tisdall. Since Hezbollah's month-long war with Israel almost 2 years ago, a political crisis has left Lebanon without a parliament or president. Over the last week, dozens of people have died in heavy fighting between Hezbollah guerrillas and pro-government forces. Hezbollah, backed by Iran, has taken over key areas of Lebanon previously held by the Western-backed government. Rival leaders are meeting Arab League mediators to try to end the fighting. Hugh McLeod is in Beirut for The Guardian.
Well, it was triggered last week when the Sunni-led Western-backed government took a decision to outlaw Hezbollah's communications network. That's a secure telephone line that the militant group uses to communicate, which it says cannot be tapped by Israel, which is its number one enemy. And the government also sacked the security chief at Beirut Airport over accusations he had aided Hezbollah set up spy cameras inside the airport. Now, Hassan Nasrallah, in a speech on Thursday, branded the government Israelis dressed in suits speaking Arabic and declared that they had declared war on his group by these decisions.
And Hezbollah now control several strategically important positions in Lebanon.
Well, initially on Thursday night, Hezbollah and Shia allies AMEL, as well as the Syrian Social National Party, swept through areas of West Beirut, which are Sunni strongholds. They took over the offices of Saad Hariri's media organization and his political party, ransacked and burned them, and took to the streets brandishing guns. They very quickly withdrew, however, after the government climbed down over these decisions to target Hezbollah's communications network. But since then, fighting flared up in the Druze majority areas, the mountains southeast of Beirut. And it's right to say, yes, Hezbollah has taken some quite important strategic high points there, which back onto their stronghold in the eastern Bekaa Valley, giving them what analysts here would say are potential supply routes between the coastal highway, which leads into their stronghold in the southern suburbs of Beirut, and the mountain roads over towards the Bekaa Valley in the east.
This has been the worst internal violence in Lebanon since the 15-year civil war ended in 1990. What is Hezbollah aiming to achieve?
It says it's aiming, first of all, to confront an American-Israeli plot to disarm its armed wing. Secondly, it wants greater representation in the government. It withdrew its ministers in November 2006 after accusing Prime Minister Senyora of being a traitor after he tabled a cabinet meeting to discuss Hezbollah's weapons in the aftermath of Hezbollah's July war 2006 against Israel. The aims of the armed takeover now are not entirely clear, however, because experts on Hezbollah here say the situation has actually inflated, it's ballooned out, because the government is not actually yet backing down officially over these decisions. Some people here are saying, you know, look, the government have had Western, had American support over the last couple of days. They're digging their heels in. This could lead Hezbollah to either elevate its demands or continue to take over strategic points in Lebanon with an eye to a future confrontation just around the corner with Israel.
And what's been the reaction of the Americans and Israelis?
Well, the Americans initially were surprisingly muted, given that this could be sort of seen as a military coup by their number one terrorist organization. I mean, an organization they branded a terrorist group back in the 1980s during the Lebanese Civil War. Initially quite muted, but George Bush is in Tel Aviv this week on a tour of the region aimed at bolstering the failing US-led peace talks between the Israelis and Palestinians. And he made very, very clear that he sees the actions of Hezbollah in Lebanon as an Iranian attempt to dominate what his administration has always said is a beacon of democracy and a free nation. The problem is the Americans have actually very little leverage left in Lebanon. They can give moral, political support, but even the stalwarts of this pro-government coalition here are sounding increasingly lost and rather desperate in terms of, you know, asking the international community for assistance. There have been reports, however, from Egypt that the USS Cole, which is an American warship, which was deployed off Lebanon in February, which the State Department said was a sign of America's commitment to stability in the region, there are reports from Egypt that that has passed through the Suez Canal and is headed back to the Mediterranean. Of course, everyone in Lebanon expects that deployment would be off Lebanese territorial waters and would play a possible role in the situation here.
Hugh MacLeod. Morgan Tsvangirai, the leader of Zimbabwe's Movement for Democratic Change, says he'll return to the country to contest a runoff election against President Robert Mugabe. The state-run election commission says Tsvangirai won the first round with about 48% of the vote to 43% for Mugabe. That meant a runoff was necessary, as neither won an outright majority. Our Africa editor, Chris McGreal, says there's been criticism of the opposition leader's decision to flee Zimbabwe.
I think there's growing disillusionment even among his supporters, particularly because he stayed out of the country for so long. I think there was a feeling that immediately after the election, when he went to rally support in the region, that was quite reasonable. But in the weeks since the election, the March 29th vote, an awful lot of people have been beaten up. Some have been killed in a systematic campaign by the state against Tsvangirai supporters. I think there's a growing feeling that he should have been back in Zimbabwe at their side, drawing attention to their plight, and there was a feeling that he had sought shelter abroad and left his supporters open and vulnerable.
And Tsvangirai had said that he wouldn't fight a second round of elections. Why did he change his mind?
I think that was a pretty unsustainable position from the start. And you could tell that from the fact that the MDC opposition party kept wavering on it. But essentially, I think he was confronted by two realities, one of which is if he didn't run, there was every chance that Robert Mugabe would simply declare himself president again by default, and the opposition would face a major problem. What could he do about that? The second was that he claims to have won outright with 50.3% of the vote. Now, that's only a fraction above the 50% threshold to avoid a runoff. And I think that there was a great risk that even though Tsvangirai has managed to whip up some support in the region, it would look as though he was shying away from a one-to-one showdown with Mugabe, and that he would find it difficult winning backing for that position. It was necessary for him to go back and contest it even if he didn't want to.
And when will the runoff ballot be held?
Well, we don't know. It should have been held within 21 days of the original election. Now, that's several weeks ago. Then there was talk of 21 days of when the results were announced, which would make the runoff by the 23rd of May. But the ruling party and the Electoral Commission are both now saying that, in fact, it could be up to a year, that the Electoral Commission has the legal authority to delay as long as a year. And that would certainly indicate that, even if it's not a year, that Mugabe intends to play for time, and it could be many months away before we see it.
Chris McGreal. My name's John Dennis. Still to come in this week's programme, a letter from India from one of our readers and a Soviet-style military parade in Moscow's Red Square. But first, the US Supreme Court has rejected a legal attempt to block the use of lethal injections. More than 30 states use lethal injections, and they hadn't executed any prisoners for more than 7 months while Supreme Court judges considered the appeal. It was the longest pause in US executions in 25 years. But less than an hour after the court delivered its verdict, William Earl Lind, who murdered his girlfriend, was executed in Georgia. Clive Stafford Smith is the legal director of Reprieve, a British group that campaigns against the death penalty.
Things like this diminish us all, and I knew William because he's been on death row there for many, many years, and I also know his lawyer, Tom Dunn, very well. Look, I've been there. I've stood outside that execution chamber in Georgia twice and looked up at the stars in the middle of the night and thought to myself, you know, was what I'd witnessed, did that achieve anything for civilization? And the answer is fairly clear.
How much of a setback to anti-death penalty campaigners is the Supreme Court's judgment?
Well, of course, it would have been wonderful to win that. And I think perhaps Justice Stevens put it best when he said, how can we really sanction executing human beings with a drug cocktail that's been banned for the death of pets? But these things come and go, and we've lost a lot over the years, but I think overall we're still winning the battle. And finally, I think we're convincing the American people that innocent people are getting executed. We've had more than 120 people exonerated off death row who 12 jurors said were guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and we proved we're innocent. So we're winning the battle. The sad thing is that there'll be a number of people like William Lind who'll die before we'll finally prevail.
Guantanamo Bay has been the focus of much of your attentions over the last few years. Americans elect a new president in 6 months' time. Can we expect Guantanamo to close with the end of the Bush era?
It may well close before the end of the Bush era. As the New York Times was reporting this week, the Bush administration is drawing up plans to close it potentially before the new president comes into office. Cynically, I suspect I know what's going to happen. I suspect that before the election, the Bush administration will move some of the big-name prisoners, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, perhaps to the continental U.S. and have a big press conference saying, we live in a very dangerous world, you've got to be afraid, vote Republican. And then I suspect that if, goodness knows, President McCain is elected as a Republican, I bet the Bush administration will close Guantanamo before he's inaugurated because they'll want to protect a new Republican from having to deal with the embarrassment. If, on the other hand, a Democrat's elected, President Obama, then I think the Bush administration cynically will leave it open and force Obama to have to close it himself.
And what will happen to the other prisoners currently held in Guantanamo if and when it closes?
Well, there'll be a number who'll be moved to America to face some sort of trial, and we still don't know what sort. There'll be a number who'll just be sent home. In fact, I was just visiting three of my clients in Sudan 2 days ago who had just been released, and there'll be a bunch more released. And then the difficulty are the 50-odd people who are refugees who have been cleared already in Guantanamo for release. The Americans say they're no threat to anyone, but they're from China or Tunisia, Algeria, Uzbekistan, places where they can't go home without facing persecution. And that's the big problem. That's where we need help from European countries to take refugees who the U.S. says are no threat to anybody so that we can get them out of Guantanamo.
What about the people detained by the U.S. elsewhere in the world? I mean, do you expect that to change with the departure of George Bush from the White House?
Well, this is really the big story here that's been so ignored for so long by people, that Guantanamo is just a diversionary tactic in the war of terror. And I guess it's best illustrated if I say that official figures put the number of ghost prisoners in secret prisons held by America around the world at 27,000, which means that the 265 people left in Guantanamo constitute less than 1%. 99% are in other places. And this is our big problem. You know, my charity, Reprieve, we're working very hard both to identify the prisons, the prisoners, and reunite them with the rule of law. And I don't think we can expect everything to become wonderful overnight, because the rendition program, where you basically grab people and take them around the world to these prisons, wasn't started by George Bush. It was initiated in the modern era in 1996 by President Clinton. And we've got a lot of convincing to do before we convince any new president that we've got to put an end to this nonsense.
Clive Stafford-Smith, many thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
It's been 17 years since Russia rolled its big guns across the historic cobbles of Moscow's Red Square. But last week, for the first time since the Soviet era, tanks and heavy weapons once again trundled past Lenin's tomb and the onion domes of St. Basil's Cathedral, as The Guardian's Luke Harding reports.
Well, I'm here in Red Square on Victory Day, 9th of May, and it's quite an amazing sight, really. Sitting in a tribune with a whole load of veterans and generals covered in medals. The parade hasn't started yet, but a whole series of regimental bands are pouring into the square. It's a beautiful sunny morning. To my right is St. Basil's Cathedral, with a huge slogan behind it saying, "To Victory Day," fluttering flags on the place where Ivan the Terrible used to execute his victims. And in front of me is GUM, the previously Soviet shopping centre, which is now full of labels like Gucci and Prada. And to my left is Lenin's tomb, where a huge stage has been erected, where President Medvedev, Russia's new president, will be sitting side by side with Prime Minister Putin, who swapped jobs this week. So it's a huge spectacle, and now I'm just waiting for the tanks. Okay, I'm here with the British defence attaché, Andy Verdon. Andy, what do you make of it? What are your impressions? What does it mean?
Well, this is my third time on Red Square to see the parade. And of course, this will be the first year in which they're parading all the armaments in good old Soviet style. I think being on this parade today, it makes you realise just what their role in the defeat of fascism in the Second World War means to the Russian people. It is the biggest singular achievement, I think, of this country, and these people are immensely proud of their role in that conflict.
But what about these enormous 22-metre intercontinental missiles which are going to be wheeled out across the cobble square of Red Square? Is this a little signal to Gordon Brown, perhaps, or to Washington? How do you make it?
Well, I wouldn't read too much into that. I mean, these people are very proud. They've been through an awful time in the 1990s. Putin has restored their pride and their self-respect, and that's very evident to anybody, any foreigner living in Russia and in Moscow today. They're immensely proud to be back on the world stage, and I suppose this is just their way of marking it. And of course, for them, it is completely normal. It is a normal thing to do. I wouldn't really read too much into it politically.
What you can hear now is the hurrahing of about 8,000 servicemen celebrating the victory over fascism 63 years ago. It's actually rather an impressive moment. The band has moved forward. This kind of wave of hurrahing is kind of billowing from left to right. Okay, Okay, this is the Iskander missile. This is the thing that's going to be allegedly parked in Kaliningrad and directed at the Bush administration's weapons system in Poland and the Czech Republic, anti-missile shield. Russia has said that if the US places an anti-defense shield in Central Europe, it'll point this at it. 22-meter long ballistic missile that could strike anywhere. Those are the MiGs just letting off fireworks over the main tribune.
Luke Harding reporting from Red Square. Well, each week we ask a reader of the print edition of Guardian Weekly or one of our listeners to give us some idea of what life's like where they are in the world. This week, Barbara Lamplu writes from South India.
Armed with a towel, clean clothes and a bar of soap each, we follow the path through the banana grove towards the temple stream, which to me looks more like a river, being at least 10 meters wide and easily deep enough to swim in. Before leaving home, Srija had rubbed coconut oil boiled with tulasi leaves into my hair to make it shine after washing in the river, with the bonus of ensuring a good night's sleep. There's one place for the men, another a discreet 50 meters away, and around a slight bend for the women. At the edge of the water are flat stones, ideal for beating our washing. Along with the other women, I immerse myself. It feels strange at first, entering the water fully clothed. My thin cotton tunic and trousers stick to me, but I soon get used to it. While the children splash around in the shallows and soak themselves, I swim up and down, enjoying the peaceful surroundings, the lush vegetation, bright with blossoms. In front of me, the reflected trees dance and shimmy in the water. Looking up, I spot a fork-tailed drongo and a vivid green bee-eater sitting on overhanging branches, unperturbed by my presence. A kingfisher flits across the water in a sudden flash of turquoise. Small transparent fish dart around me, occasionally brushing against my body. On the bank, three young goats munch grass. As I swim back down to the bathing place, the chorus of screeching, hooting and chirruping birds is punctuated by the regular thwack of washing being slapped on stones. Srija swims a few leisurely strokes, but mostly the women are there to wash themselves and their clothes. After assiduously soaping their bodies, they submerge their heads in the water, noses firmly held, then float on their backs, long black hair streaming behind them. A shelter made from banana leaves gives enough privacy to change into dry clothes. Then it's back ankle-deep into the river to wash those we were wearing earlier. I take my cue from the other women, soaping my clothes on the rock, bashing, rinsing, wringing, and laying out to dry. As the sun begins to sink lower, I sit under the banyan tree, waiting while Srija and the children go into the temple. Families are arriving. Sounds of music and chanting drift out from the temple precinct, and we walk home in the fading light.
Barbara Lamplu. This edition of Guardian Weekly was produced by Ian Chambers. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
Great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.